space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
It was that ant that stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss, they're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Didn't that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Blast off!
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Wow, that was unexpected. Ah! Give me just a second here. Dead blast it.
Thank you.
I make music with my friends.
He's got a laptop.
There it is.
He's got a laptop.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, hope to get to the point that they know it's possible with this today's show. But first, I apologize for that intro there. It's kind of like sleep at the wheel. I got to have this long intro. I know it's obnoxious, but got to be able to push a lot of buttons and get everything sorted out and make sure everybody gets to hear what it is we're trying to say here at ChazizRadio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html and do it regardless of whatever doggone Google tries to tell you, because it's we're not trying to get anybody's information or give you any kind of hassle or anything like that. All we're trying to do is put some good information out there on the table. And as well as if you're in the Super Chat room, scroll down underneath there and you'll see this nifty little banner that says People for People Radio Network. Click on that radio network and go over there and say hi. Tell them that crazy-haired mad science guy Shaziz said to come over there and crash your party and stuff. So anyway, I got some podcasts that I want to go through, and as per usual, I'll probably stop it and mouth off a little bit. You know how I am. Because mad science wouldn't be mad science without somebody, some mad scientist telling you why he's mad about ridiculousness that's going on. I mean, in reality, they know it's possible to get free energy. You know it's possible to get free energy, but why? Why ain't we got there so far? You know, NASA makes all these amazing claims of things that they do and technologies available. And they're always talking about, you know, things like fusion being 30 years into the future. And then 30 years pass. And then, oh, well, 30 more years into the future. And then 30 more years pass. And then, oh, well, you know, 30 more years. Keep on moving the bar, you know. And that's aggravating because nuclear fusion is already a reality regardless of what people try to say. It's where you cram two, you know, atoms, the protons, and they ain't got no choice but to merge together, and they release a massive amount of heat energy and stuff. But even at that, you don't even have to go that far to nuclear fusion to actually get heat. You know, there's heat losses in every single system. So even if we was to only work for incredible efficiency, we would still have enough heat energy to do amazing amounts of work. You know, for example, if you go look at the internal combustion engine and the lack of efficiency in even the most high-tech of the sports cars out there, there's a lot of thermal energy, just ridiculous amounts of thermal energy being wasted. And so they got to figure out really high-tech ways to cool these things down. And we're even talking about the electric cars as well. You know, electric circuits, they get hot because of the resistance and the current that they're shoving through these doggone things. And they'll get hot, so they got to disperse that heat. Well, where's that heat energy go? Most generally just right straight out into the atmosphere, and so it gets wasted, completely and utterly wasted. There was a term called cold electricity back in the day whenever everybody was looking into alternative energy. And if you look deep into it, I won't be going into that today, but nonetheless, you know, cold electricity, what would that do? You know, would that be something that you wouldn't even have to have doggone superconductors in order to be able to move electricity from point A to point B? I say, yeah, you wouldn't have to have that. Voltage, it doesn't work the same way as current does. Voltage is pressure, and so voltage doesn't meet the resistance that you would think. You know, you actually have to have high voltage diodes to slow down a lot of the power in certain circumstances so that they don't blow up capacitors or whatever. Too much voltage, too much pressure too fast is like blowing up a balloon real fast and then pow! The balloon explodes. Well, if you got a place for that energy to go and that balloon can never ever fill itself up and can't overpressurize too rapidly, then you got all the current that you're going to need real time. And so moving energy around using electricity differently than we do now, you know, all of our equipment, everything that we use so inefficiently. We have to have resistors and stuff in order to slow down that current to keep just the right amount of power going to these things so that they don't reach their thermal breakdown and fail. Now, if you use that electricity properly from the get-go, before you ever even put it into the device, and the device only requires so much amount of power in order to run that particular device. I mean, for example, you know, you plug your outlet, depending on which country you're in, plug your alarm clock in there, it only takes 9 volts AC or 9 volts DC, depending on which model of alarm clock you got, to actually run that circuit that runs the digital readout on there. And so you don't need near the amount of power that you're pushing to that particular device. So the power bounces back and forth between the wall outlet and the transformer inside this thing that's actually going to step that voltage down and then rectify it so that the 12-volt or the 9-volt circuit inside there could actually run the device without getting hot and reaching its thermal breakdown point and failing. So why are we pushing so much power to everything? Every single thing out there, including fan motors, any electrical device that you got, there's 120 volts AC over here in the United States, and overseas I think they're on the 220, and we're using 60 hertz here while they're using 50 hertz over there. I'd be willing to bet their appliances last a lot longer than our appliances because of the differences in energy, you know, the frequency range at what they're actually pushing it out, you know, towards that device. If you're putting too much power to any given device, it's going to cause resistance inside there, which is also going to cause this doggone thing to generate heat. That heat is the enemy of your devices. But the thing about it is that heat really the enemy of the energy industry? Could you use that energy in a different manner? I mean, we know how to generate heat. We do this all the doggone time with the devices that we want to use. But in the process of using that, the amount of current flow that it requires to push the energy to any given device causes a backup of power. And that backup of power is kind of like at the bottom of a waterfall, you know, all that energy coming down, it makes that real, that bottom base of the waterfall down there in the pool, it makes it all turbulent and everything's moving around. So you could actually measure the temperature in that water by the bottom of that waterfall and the temperature downstream, and you're going to notice a difference because of all those molecules being bashed around and stuff like that. It's the same concept. If you understand the way that water functions and pressure and all that, then you understand electricity. And if you understand plumbing, then you understand electronics. It's that simple. But, you know, the high-tech terminology people out there and the people that, you know, have the big degrees and all that, you know, they got their own languages for every single deal under the sun, every single job that you're out there. Doctors don't talk the same way as electricians and so on down the line, or plumbers, vice versa. But when you look at the world mechanically, if you look at energy mechanically, you'll start seeing a different thing there. It's all working the same way. There's pressure, there's current, there's flow, and all this. And every time you use any type of energy, you generate heat from the friction. That's why they're always trying to say you can never get more in than you get out because there's so many losses in the system. Well, why is there so many losses in the system? Because they're under-engineered in some cases, most cases, but then they're over-engineered in other cases, but they neglect the laws of physics and not figuring out that you got to figure out a way right from the get-go to find the weakest point in that system that will reach its thermal breakdown first and start from that point and be able to move that energy away from that particular part in the machine. Otherwise, that machine is going to break down at its weakest point. And so when that happens, well, obvious reasons, you got to go out and buy a new a new motor for your car, a new electric fan, or whatever. You know, sometimes with just a little bit of maintenance, you could actually make your electric fan last for decades as opposed to years, you know, just by understanding that, you know, whenever you're blowing that fan one direction, it's sucking all the dust out of the air into that fan, and that dust begins to cake up, which makes a thermal blanket over the top of those coils that you need to try to keep cool by that airflow going across there. So something as simple as blowing the dust off the back of your motors and keeping them clean will make those things last a whole lot longer than they would otherwise. Not to mention that they're, you know, some of the ways that they use bearings are not bearings like you'd actually think as ball bearings, but they're kind of like a little slip ring inside there. And to keep those things greased every once in a while, then you can extend the life of that little bearing. And so with that said, there's two different ways where you can make an electric fan last a whole lot longer than you would think. but everything without the proper maintenance will reach its thermal breakdown, and when it does, then something has to give. And so that's why we're out there buying all these new appliances all the time. And the same thing applies with whether it be your toaster or your light bulbs or whatever. The amount of energy that you're pushing to these devices is not necessary to make the actual device function properly. So I've proven a long time ago that you can light up a tungsten element with 20,000 volts in the milliwatt range, milliamp range. It's, it's not being used exactly the same way as the amount of current. See, tungsten and nichrome wire, the elements that they are most commonly used in light bulbs and heater systems, electric heaters and such, those require current. So it's the resistance of that current that actually causes those elements to get hot and basically, generate the heat that you want. But it takes a lot of power in order to do that, anywhere from 5 to 1500 watts or whatever, depending on which particular heater system that you buy. But what if I said you could take that same exact device and use electricity differently at a higher frequency that would resonate those doggone wires and be able to do the same exact job for bare minimum of input, a whole lot less amount of power than you would otherwise use by plugging it directly into the wall outlet. Now, these aren't things that a lot of people think about. When you talk about high voltage, there are precautions that need to be taken in consideration, and to be able to use different types of high voltage, high frequencies or whatever, you might have to change a few things. So some few modifications, such as some wire that would resist high voltage from breaking down through the actual wire coating itself, and so there are a few obstacles, but nothing that we couldn't overcome with the amount of information that we've got available, the laws of physics, thermodynamics, and so on. If you look in the back of your TV set, there's a thin wire that runs to your TV tube. It's a high voltage power source, but the insulation around it will withstand thousands of volts as opposed to 120 or 220 volts AC. And you're not pushing it the same way that you would the other. You're just pushing current. You're pushing voltage, not current. And there's reasoning behind that. But I won't get into all that either. What I want to get into is technologies. And if you listen really closely to some of the words being said in these deals and the dates that they're talking about, how long this technology's actually been available, just listen to some of these ideas, some of these concepts. A new way to turn sun's power into energy is one of the videos that I'm going to get ready to play right here. So bear with me, and I hope to get to the final conclusion that they already know it's possible. And why ain't they doing it? All right, well, obvious reasons. You don't want to make it so that you can't sell coal. You don't want to make it so that you can't sell oil, all of which they're always complaining about causes global warming / climate change, which you all know how I feel about that ridiculousness. But nonetheless, giving the devil their due, if they say that's a problem and they have the solution available, but they are not actually enacting the solutions, then that ought to tell you something. They don't want to get off of what they call fossil fuel. And even to that extent, the terminology itself is basically a misleading term, fossil fuel itself. There is absolutely no such thing as fossil fuel. I don't care how much your education has convinced you or your indoctrination has convinced you that there were dinosaurs that made all this oil and that was the only place that you can actually get crude oil. And since there's no more dinosaurs, there's not going to be any more crude oil made. Then you pretty much bought into the lie. Because the fact of the matter is, something as simple as algae, there's more oil in algae than there is in actual crude oil. So with that said, there's all kinds of different plants that you're not going to eat, you know, the leaves off your tree, duckweed, watermill, things that could actually be turned into biofuels that, you know, would blow your doors off. Every single thing out there is fuel. Every single thing out there is energy, regardless of what the system tries to tell you. So mad science is here to point that kind of stuff out in hopes that it'll generate the interest in all the other average Joes out there to bring their talents and their skills together and get the job done that they claim they want. You know, they say they want to save the planet. They're trying to tell all the children of the planet, of the Earth, the flat Earth, whatever it is you think it is, doesn't matter. It's not the shape it is, it's the shape it is in that is the problem. So if you want to save the environment, if you want to save the Earth, the world, or whatever, as far as energy usage and pollution, then this is probably the way that you might want to start thinking, and then you'll figure out that we already always had free energy. And the reason why they don't want you to have free energy should be blatantly obvious by now. Go look at the prices of the fuel at the gas pump. Go look at the prices of the food in the grocery store and ask yourself why. Why is everything getting so high? Why is everything so expensive? Well, that's because you're willing to go to work. You and your wife both, gentlemen, you and your wife both, or whatever. You know, you go to work, both of you, making some money. You give a portion of it to the government, you give another portion of it to the government inadvertently, and you give another portion of it to the energy industry, and another portion of it to the medical industry, and another portion of it to the food industry, and another portion of it to the drug industry. So you got all these different little chunks coming out of your hard-earned living. And they're telling you that, well, we got to raise your bills up because we got to do this for society. Well, if you, the average Joe, are tired of having your doggone bills jacked up every time you turn around, not to mention your insurance, which is attached to, you know, all these other industries, whether it be health or auto insurance or homeowners insurance, you got to be insured for protection so that you got everything you need. In order, in case something, worst case scenario comes down the pipe. Well, what if you all decided to work together and you took care of each other, you insured each other, you insured one another, and you developed clean, renewable, safe energies that won't cause the problems? It won't be burning down your shack, so to speak. That's some good coffee. So anyway, let's move right along. I'm going to play this portion right here. Let's see where we go.
Now, we're all used to solar-powered panels like these. They work by absorbing photons from the sun, which displace electrons from atoms and thus generate electricity. The system works by light, not heat. But if you've ever played with a magnifying glass in the sun as a kid, you know that light can create intense heat. And that was the starting point for our next startup, Heliobis.
The light passes through the top layer, it reflects in the second layer onto the thermal receiver where there's a coolant flowing through. The coolant is heated up and it's basically creating thermal energy. We're heating something up. Just, you know, the magnifying glass, larger scale, that's how it's done. And we produce steam. The steam can be directly used in the industry. You know, you have the applications in agriculture, which, you know, pasteurizing milk, anything that needs to be heat treated, you have it in the steel industry. Or steel industry, you know, you have different stages of preheating steel. You can use it there. You can use it for cooling, for solar cooling, solar heating, or you can just feed it into a turbine and produce electricity.
So it can be used in a more traditional sense and be turned into, this thermal energy can be turned into electricity.
Of course, of course. I mean, this technology at its core, it's nothing new. It's been there since the beginning of the century.
So you re-engineered.
We re-engineered.
Technology that's exactly. Already been around and has been around for some time.
Exactly. We are making the concentrated solar power from high tech to smart tech. So we're a smart engineering company. And
all right, there's one first example. Been around for a long time. Already been around for a long time. They just re-engineered it. So let's keep going.
All of this just allowed us to bring down the cost. You know, we're 55% cheaper than comparable glass-based technology.
55% cheaper?
Yeah, on the capital expenditure.
So right now you have a prototype. So
exactly.
You've gone to market.
Exactly.
But it's a prototype at this particular
point. It's the first industrial application.
How far away are you from actually then going forward and bringing this to market?
Well, right now we have a semi-automatic plant in Austria. We already have plans and designs for a fully automatic plant, and we're in the steps of getting it built right now. So once that is up and running, the costs will drop down significantly. And also there's the economies of scale. You know, once you outsource the production, the material, everything, the costs drop down significantly.
So,
still watching?
Scale it up.
Click here to watch another great...
Alright, so scale it up and the cost starts going down. Alright, so let's move right along. This particular video right here, I actually kind of thumbed it down because of one of the deals at the very end. I hope to catch it before it actually gets there, but still has some points to be made. And so with that said, let's go. Correction, wasn't this video. It's the next one in line. Alright, let's keep going anyway.
Hey everybody, Dutch Sense here. 10 a.m. Central Time on Monday, March 23rd, 2015. And I've got you over here on the Wall Street Journal, and we've got more breaking news this month of March. Now, this came out on March 11th, so a week and a half ago. But this is breaking news, nobody talking about it, so I want to bring it to your attention. Japan advances in space-based solar power. Now, what this is having to do with is wireless power transmission using microwaves. Again, we're back to the talk of using microwaves to transmit power. Now, let me just go ahead and read this to you really quick. It is one small 55-meter step for Japan's aerospace industry, but perhaps a giant leap into developing a new energy source for mankind. The Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, or JAXA, said it succeeded in transmitting electric power wirelessly to a pinpoint target using microwaves, which is an essential technology needed for the realization of space-based solar power.
Okay, let's pause this for a second. So they're going to absorb energy from the sun and then beam that energy in the form of a microwave down to a pinpoint area where they can collect that energy to produce heat. But here's the thing, folks. Stinks to be the bird that flies in front of that, because he's going to get microwaved. He's going to get nuclearized, so to speak. You talk about... They're sitting there trying to say that solar panels were actually catching birds on fire when they fly over them, which is a big hockahoo, but nonetheless, it's all ridiculousness. But if you try to do something like what these folks are talking about, then that's going to mean you got no fly zones in different areas wherever that doggone beam is, because if you go flying through that right there, you might as well just stick your head in a microwave and, you know, hit it on there and see how long you can last. Which isn't probably going to be very long, because there's water in your body, and since water is a dipole molecule, it is affected by microwaves. So that's why they tell you to go around all these big radio towers, not to stand too close to this radio tower, because it's emitting microwaves. So you don't want microwaves blasting in through your body, because it'll heat you up from the inside out. But nonetheless, let's give the devil his due. Let's keep on rolling, because this technology, while the concept of how they want to do it is ridiculous, still is good technology if you use it properly. You know, don't learn about electrical safety by accident. Also, don't learn about microwave safety by accident.
According to a spokesman at the agency, the researchers were able to transform 1.8 kilowatts of electric power into microwaves and transmit it with an accuracy into a receiver located 55 meters or 60 yards away. The microwave was successfully converted into direct electrical current at the receiving end. The experiment was conducted on Sunday in Hyogo Prefecture in western Japan. Now it goes on to talk about space-based solar power. U.S. Department of Energy. I'm going to go ahead and put a video after this. I've had this on my channel now for the last 2 years. Not many people have seen it. You need to see it. Okay? They're using radar to transmit wireless power back in 1975.
Pause! Using radar to transfer wireless power back in 1975. 1975. What's this? The year 2019? Somebody do the math. Let's see. Somebody throw that math up there from 1975 all the way to the year 2019. See who's quick on the draw with the math. But anyway, let's keep rolling.
In the same frequency that our Wi-Fi is on now, 2.45 gigahertz, also Bluetooth. And NEXRAD radar, just a little bit above that, 2.7. So in that 2 gigahertz bandwidth, transmitting wireless power. And all it's about is what's at the receiving end. If you've got an antenna and you hook that up in series with a diode, a low-pass filter, either a bandpass filter or a low-pass filter, and then run that into a DC to DC converter, that's your wireless power setup, guys. Here, I'll put a diagram here on the screen, and I'll put links down below. Now, you're playing with potentially, I suppose, a lot of power. So if you do build this, of course, be careful. But, I might have to look into building a couple of these. I mean, if it's proved that 2.45 gigahertz can be transmitted, then we need to build the receiver antennas now. The Rectenna, R-E-C-T-E-N-N-A, with the receiving diodes. The diodes is going to convert, supposedly, the AC that develops in the antenna to DC. It's a rectifier. So you need a rectifier diode and then a low-pass filter, and then you're going to need to obviously convert that from into some kind of usable DC. But potential out of air is whatever the transmission source is. So I know around me, for instance, all my neighbors have their own Wi-Fi running at roughly the same gigahertz bandwidth. Several of them most likely the same even routers. So if you got the same kind of antenna to pick up that signal, well, guess what? You're going to be able to convert that into power. Now, they're doing this on a massive scale, collecting the solar power and beaming it down to Earth in just massive amounts. But locally, at your house, you could theoretically build your own and convert that into power. And not, you could talk on your cell phone right next to it. It's not going to mess with your cell phone signal at all because it's only picking up.
All right, let's pause this again for a second. See, the thing about it is the technology to actually generate a microwave has been around forever and a day, but nonetheless, the modern-day microwave is different than the old-style microwaves. The old-style microwaves had to have a microwave oven transformer. For the geeks out there, that would be a short MOT for short. MOT, microwave oven transformer. And those took a lot of current in order to change that voltage coming out of the wall into a higher voltage in order to do the job. So the voltage coming out of the wall had two jobs, one to heat up an element and the other one to knock electrons off with the high voltage, high frequency, and basically change that into a microwave in order to cook your food. So with that said, the newer ones, they actually use inverter technology, which doesn't have an actual transformer like you'd think. Instead, it uses power MOSFETs and timing circuits in order to do the same exact job with a whole lot less power input. So, with that said, let's keep on rolling here.
It's not transmitting anything. It's not sucking in anything like a black hole. It's literally whatever hits that antenna is going to be converted into power. And you can stand right behind it, right next to it, in front of it, and still talk on your phone, and there's no loss of power to the cell phone company, no harm, no foul to anybody, except for pulling that out of the air. It's already going to hit your walls, it's already going to go into the ground, whatever. You're just pulling that out of the air and converting that into DC current. And that's what wireless power is. That's how they're able to do it with microwaves. Microwaves travel across the distance, hit the antenna. The antenna, of course, AC current in the antenna, travels down the antenna, then you need a way to rectify that into DC current that's usable. And, of course, then there's the apparatus for wireless power transmission. I hope that explains it, guys. Big news, again, of course, you need to come over to my channel and check out the other stuff that's going on. I'll put links down below to my blog, to my website, so you can check out what's going on over there. But we've got another breaking news story in regards to directed energy today, and that's that Boeing filed patents for force field technology using microwaves that blocks incoming explosions, the shockwaves from explosions. So if an explosion happens, it will block the shockwave and protect whatever, the truck, the Humvee. They've got a diagram of a Humvee with two transmitters on it, and it forming a scalar, pointing in a certain direction, targeting that down to a point, and that's where plasma forms, and it forms a plasma shield that protects the object that's transmitting. It's crazy, but there it is. They filed the patent on it. They just did that. So this is kind of like breaking news today across the board, apparently, on weather modification. I'm surprised nobody else talked about the wireless power transmission. Again, guys, I've had it up on the channel. Let's just go ahead and show it to you here. And, of course, I'm going to play it here at the end. Let's go ahead and scroll down. Here it is, right here. Radar used to transmit power to distant rectenna. And, again, the rectenna is the receiving antenna, that converts the energy into DC. You're taking microwave that's coming down an antenna, you're rectifying that into a DC current, and then using that DC current. And the efficiency is greater than power traveling down a wire.
That's good. That gives
you any perspective
resistance
of what we're talking about here. So if you've got a cell phone tower up the street broadcasting out at 35,000 watts, I suppose potential, if you had an antenna up sticking up off the top of your house, the potential for receiving that is up to 35,000 watts, right? I mean, if the law, or a little less than that, 85% of that, whatever 85% of 35,000 watts is, but that's still a huge amount of wattage available. And we're talking about voltage and amperage available out of that wattage. So what kind of volts, what kind of amps, that's going to depend on, I guess, on your antenna and on your rectifying diode. So I guess the better the diode, the better the antenna, the better the wattage you're going to get out of the air. It's just that simple. And if you guys understand electronics, you know exactly what I'm talking about there. So the diagrams are down below for that from the NASA experiment done from the Goldstone radar here in 1975. And the article link is down below so you guys can go check out the article that was released on this by the Wall Street Journal. It's amazing times, guys. It really is amazing times to be alive. Be safe.
Alright, so wireless energy transfer, but first I got to clarify, Stephen in chat room said that the microwave magnetron is what creates the wave, bro, not the transformer, which is correct. So the transformer takes the power from the primary and it ramps it up through the secondary to over a couple thousand volts. That couple thousand volts and the initial power that comes in, you have 120 volts AC, like I said, depending on which country you're in, 120 volts or 220, regardless. And so that goes through the primary, and that ramps the voltage really high and changes the frequency range of that. And then by the time the regular voltage goes through the inside of the magnetron, it heats up an element inside that magnetron, and then that high voltage from the secondary is actually knocking electrons off into a vacuum, which is basically has a couple magnets on the opposite side guiding that those electrons in a certain direction towards what would be the equivalence of an antenna out the end of that magnetron. So those electrons get to spinning really fast inside that vacuum. The actual magnetron itself is the equivalence of a light bulb. That can be easily proven, and all you have to do is put voltage to it, some current, you know, at 120 volts or 220, and turn the light off, and you'll actually see that thing lighten up because it's getting hot inside there. Well, then the second deal is when the high voltage comes in and knocks electrons off inside that vacuum, and they start getting guided and spun around inside there until out the other end you end up with a basically a radio wave, a microwave coming out the other end that basically is guided into your microwave oven and starts to bounce around back and forth through the water molecules inside there and rocks them so rapidly that produce friction, which in turn produces heat. So hopefully that clarified everything. Anyway, if you understand that, though, the microwave oven and wireless energy transfer using microwaves and stuff like that, you can start to get a picture of different ways in order to actually generate heat at lower amounts of power. That's why I mentioned the newer microwave ovens. They use inverter technology as opposed to the old transformer, so to speak. Anyway, so moving right along, this next one is the one I said that the very last of this, I got to stop it because it's stupid people, but it still has some information.
Homonews presents Clean Energy Solutions. Australian firm builds underwater buoys to tap ocean swell energy. An Australian company has been working on a system that uses underwater buoys to convert sea waves into zero-emission energy and desalinated water. Australian firm Carnegie Wave Energy has been developing a system called CETO, which aims to utilize sea waves to generate power. Steel-made buoys that can currently generate 240 kilowatts are the main part of the system. At the test site at the Australian Naval Base, HMAS Stirling, three buoys were placed 11 kilometers apart. The buoys are less susceptible to extreme weather damage, while underwater waves are sufficient to generate power. The buoys' pumps drive the high-pressure water to an onshore power plant via a subsea pipe. The high-pressure water spins the turbines, which then generates zero-carbon electricity. The CETO system can be used to power a desalinization plant as well. High-pressure water can be used to remove salt from seawater through reverse osmosis. The Australian company believes that the cost of the electricity generated by the CETO system will be competitive with diesel if it is deployed at a large scale.
Rain or shine, future solar panels may be able to generate power. Scientists in China are producing solar panels that can produce energy from the last source you'd expect when we're talking about solar energy, rainwater. In a typical solar panel, photons from a light source knock electrons free from atoms within the panel, and the action generates a flow of electricity. Although solar power technology has been getting increasingly efficient, there's still the tiny problem that solar cells can't produce any power when it's raining. Researchers are introducing a new type of solar panel by adding a layer of graphene or carbon atoms arranged in a honeycomb structure to dye-sensitized solar cells. A flexible layer of indium tin oxide and plastic is included underneath. Graphene has unusual properties that allow electrons to move freely throughout the entire layer. Rainwater contains positively charged ions like ammonium, calcium, and sodium. When water binds to the panel's surface, a double layer of positive ions and negatively charged electrons is created, which ends up producing a voltage and current. Tests of the new solar panels have been able to produce hundreds of microvolts, which is small even compared to a standard AA battery. So there's a long way to go before the new solar panels become more widely used, but more efficient future versions could mean big things for the solar industry.
All right, let's pause it there. When you're talking about rainwater, there's still piezoelectrics, and there's also the Lord Kelvin device that basically used water drops to produce high voltages and such. So, you know, all these technologies combined could make those solar panels so ridiculously effective, efficient in multiple different weather conditions, that there's something to be said about that particular one there. So let's keep going.
Japanese engineer develops turbine that loves typhoons. A new type of wind mechanism being developed in Japan is designed to not only harness power from the wind, but also to be particularly effective during typhoons. A typhoon turbine created by a Japanese engineer consists of three vertical blades and a central rod. It has an omnidirectional axis so that it can respond to wind coming from every direction. The turbine makes use of the principle of the Magnus effect. Air curves when passing by a rotating object, and the downward deflection of the airflow produces a lifting force that counteracts the force of gravity, enabling the object to remain airborne. The blades are controlled by the central rod, which can be tightened to slow down or stop the blades completely, regardless of the external forces. Under normal circumstances, the Typhoon turbine can achieve about 30% efficiency, while a conventional wind turbine can achieve 40%. However, conventional wind turbines can be damaged by typhoons, while the Typhoon turbine would still function normally in a large storm. The designer of the Typhoon turbine believes a single typhoon would be able to generate enough energy to power Japan for 50 years. According to the Japan Guide, about 7 or 8 typhoons pass over Okinawa Prefecture each year, with about 3 hitting its main islands. If the Typhoon turbine is proven to be functional under extreme weather, then Japan could harvest a significant amount of energy to power itself for a long time. This solar panel runs on bacteria power. Researchers at Binghamton University have come up with an interesting way to harness energy, using a resource we have far too much of, bacteria. To harness power from bacteria, scientists arranged 9 biosolar cells in a 3x3 pattern to form a scalable and stackable panel. The cells use cyanobacteria, which can be found in aquatic and terrestrial habitats, as a source of clean and sustainable energy. In the daytime, oxygen and electrons are released through photosynthetic reactions. At night, electrons are produced from the bacteria's respiratory activities. 5.59 microwatts were generated in 12-hour day-to-night cycles over a total of 60 hours. Solar panels produce about 200 watts in a 6x10 configuration. The biosolar cells in the same pattern will only generate 3.726 100,000th watts. Though not the most efficient, the technology has the potential to be a more reliable energy source. Once the panel is functional, it could power small wireless systems in remote areas where frequent battery changes are impractical. The Binghamton team's work has been published in the journal Sensors and Actuators B Chemical.
Bionic Leaf turns solar energy into liquid fuel. U.S. scientists have developed a bionic leaf that can convert solar energy into liquid fuel. Scientists used a bionic leaf that mimics the chemical processes in photosynthesis to split water into hydrogen and oxygen. A bacteria called Ralstonia eutropha then converts the hydrogen gas into protons and electrons. They are then integrated into carbon dioxide molecules as part of the reproductive cycle of the bacteria to form the liquid fuel isopropanol. Although isopropanol is a combustible liquid fuel, it is currently mostly used as a household disinfectant and as an industrial drying agent to remove water from fuels.
Quantum dot coating can turn windows into solar panels. Researchers at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico have developed a film of quantum dots that can turn windows into photovoltaic systems. When sunlight hits conventional silicon solar panels, electrons break free of the top layer of semiconducting material. The electrons then follow conductors between the positive and negative sides of the panel to generate an electrical current. Quantum dots, which have an inner core, an outer shell, and a silica coat, can be used as semiconductors. Quantum dots can be spread into thin sheets that are placed onto glass window panes. When photons from sunlight hit a quantum dot, it excites the electron in the valence band and sends it into the conduction band, leaving a hole behind. When the electron recombines with the hole in the valence band, a new photon with lower energy is generated. This new photon then propagates within the glass via internal reflections. Energy is generated when the propagating photons reach the window's frame, where solar cells are stored. Coatings of quantum dots can be used on any window to turn them into harvesters of sunlight at lower cost than is currently available. Los Alamos-based startup Ubiquitous Quantum Dots has received a $225,000 grant from the National Science Foundation to commercialize this technology as a coating on windows. Netherlands set to spend 150 million euros on biogas production. The Netherlands has found a use for their cows other than pumping milk, turning their manure into energy. Manure processing is important to the Netherlands, as about 10% of the country's greenhouse gas emissions come from agriculture, mostly methane from animal manure. The International Dairy Federation says the nation's livestock produces about 74 million tons of manure a year, which is too much to be directly applied to farmland as fertilizer. The excessive amount of nutrients could leak into underground water, resulting in algae growth and pollution to nearby water sources. To solve this problem, officials have implemented an experiment at one farm. Cow manure is put through an anaerobic digester, where exposure to bacteria transforms solid manure into liquid form. The resulting substance then releases biogas that is made mostly of methane and carbon dioxide. The biogas can be used as fuel, while any leftover manure can be used as fertilizer. This experiment reportedly generated 9,342 kilowatt hours of electricity in 20 days, which is enough to power 3 homes for a year. The Dutch government has committed to investing 150 million euros to the biogas program, which aims to get 1,000 large farms across the country to produce energy from cow manure within 4 years.
Let's pause that just for a second there. See, and they like to say that there ain't no such thing as free energy, but you just heard them talk about a method by which to extract energy from the droppings of all the cattle out there, including chickens and whatever, you know. So even the cows are producing free energy, man. I don't get it. And you think these folks don't know that it's possible to have free energy? Well, if you do think that, then you obviously haven't been paying attention to mad science. So let's keep rolling here.
France planning to pave roads with solar panels. The French government is set to go ahead with energy plans to pave 1,000 kilometers of its country's roads with solar panels. France's energy minister, Ségolène Royal, made the announcement last month, saying she expects tests to begin as soon as this spring. The panels are made by Colas, a subsidiary of French industrial giant Bouygues, and took 5 years to develop. These 7-millimeter thick Wattway solar panels contain photovoltaic cells, which collect solar energy through a thin layer of polycrystalline silicon. The panels will be glued to existing road surfaces and can withstand the passage of heavy goods vehicles. The manufacturers say road surfaces are occupied by vehicles only around 10% of the time, so the panels will get plenty of exposure to the sun. The panels can provide electricity for street lights, street furniture, road signs, and buildings. The manufacturers say 4 meters of solarized road can power one household, and 1 kilometer can produce enough electricity for a town of 5,000 people. If it reaches its maximum potential, the plan could provide electricity for 5 million people, or about 8% of France's population. The cost of the project is unknown, but the French government has suggested it could pay for it by raising taxes on petrol. Last year, the world's first road to convert sunlight into electricity opened on a 100-meter stretch of carriageway in the Netherlands.
All right, let's pause that again for a second. Going to pave the roads with solar panels, and they're going to raise taxes on petrol, gasoline, fuel, fossil fuel. They're going to raise taxes on it so that they can afford to put the, paved roads with solar panels. What about different types of technology like thermoelectrics in the asphalt of the street as well? All you got to do is have a temperature difference and the Seebeck effect, which between two different types of materials, you get this these two hot, where they touch, and then, as long as there's a temperature difference in that wire at the other end, then it will continue to generate a small electrical charge. So, with that said, thermocouples, thermal piles, and even Peltier elements have potential to actually generate electricity. So, there's other options to that specific one there that, not just solar, but the actual heat that it would be generated by the friction of the tires going down the street, plus the sun beating down on the thing. And because of the way that asphalt streets are actually made, they seem to be able to absorb some temperature some heat and hold that over a little bit into the night. So until that doggone road actually starts to cool down, then it's still going to be generating electricity. That there's a difference in the temperature from the actual road to the atmosphere outside or even the ground next to it. There are all kinds of ideas that are possible. Now let's see. Let's move on into this portion right here.
Toyota showcased its hydrogen fuel cell vehicle called the Mirai at the 2016 San Francisco Auto Show last November. According to Toyota product specialist Chris Petzler,
once we extract hydrogen out of things, it's a limitless source of fuel. We don't burn it, so it's completely clean.
Petzler says Toyota sees this as the fuel of the future, but how does it actually work?
You fill the tanks with compressed hydrogen gas, pure hydrogen. Whenever you step on the accelerator, it feeds hydrogen into the fuel cell, which then mixes with oxygen, which we just get from the ambient air. We have two scoops on the front end of the car and a compressor that pushes oxygen in. The hydrogen and the oxygen want to bind, but we force them through a micron-thin layer of platinum, so the electron can't make that binding process, so it kind of goes around. We capture that as electricity, and then the hydrogen and the oxygen bind on the other side, which H2O, all we're left with is water vapor, so that's the byproduct, and then...
Okay, let's pause that for a second. That's hydrogen technology, and if you paid close attention, you'll hear he said that they don't burn the hydrogen. All they do is force it through a system and drag oxygen from the atmosphere out and push it through across these plates where they can't have the option to recombine with each other, but in the process produce electricity that they in turn run their electric motors with. So that's the simple of the whole thing.
Electricity, of course, runs the car.
Although driving a car that emits water vapor could be a bonus, there are still a few hurdles ahead.
Getting the infrastructure into place, getting more pumps, that is our challenge.
According to the U.S. Department of Energy's website, there are only 14 public hydrogen fueling stations in the United States.
All right, so pause that there for a second again. Once again, the technology is already there to do this. The problem is they don't have the infrastructure as far as the fueling station. They're talking about the United States has 14 of these fueling stations to push hydrogen into these specific vehicles. However, the technology does exist to get hydrogen on demand. Stan Myers proved it all the way back into the 70s when he's driving around in a dune buggy using hydrogen technology and radio waves to actually separate it as opposed to electrolysis. So that technology combined with this technology that's already proven, it's already on the market, they would not have 14 fuel stations that pump hydrogen if they did not already have the technology, the knowledge. They already know, folks. These folks, they know it's possible. They've already done it. And so they're gearing up to, in the future, when they do make a shift over to these types of technologies, that they still are able to charge you for it. That's the whole doggone dirty little secret about the energy industry. As long as they can charge you for something that nature has already provided for free, they can stay in business. So that's the key. Keep moving.
7 of them are in California. Petzler says Toyota is working towards a solution.
We're releasing our patents on the car and fuel cell stations. So we have a company called First Element that's helping us in California, Air Liquide in France.
The Mirai accelerates from 0 to 60 miles per hour in 9 seconds, and it takes around 5 minutes to refuel.
Unique wind system may be key to bringing electricity to developing areas. A Minnesota wind turbine company has signed a licensing agreement that will see its energy technology be used in the Netherlands. Shear Wind has a patented system of harvesting wind power that can produce 6 times more green energy than traditional systems called Envelox for increased velocity. The funnel-shaped Envelox system captures wind from all directions, even with speeds as low as 2 miles per hour. The wind is then funneled through a duct where it picks up speed. The accelerated wind is delivered to the generators on the ground level, where its kinetic energy is harnessed to produce electricity. Any residual wind will be returned to the environment. Unlike conventional turbines, Envelox keeps its generators on the ground rather than on top. This allows it to produce 600% more power. With its capabilities, the powerful device can be used not just commercially, but also in developing nations and in areas where electricity is not readily accessible. Cameroon turns human waste into clean power. Two towns in Cameroon are installing biogas systems to turn human waste into sustainable energy that can provide fuel and electricity for local communities. Organic material such as animal waste is placed inside an airtight tank where bacteria and archaea break down the material. This releases biogas, which is a byproduct that is a mixture of mostly methane with some carbon dioxide. The biogas can be stored and burned as a fuel for cooking and to power electricity generators, while the rest of the waste can be used as fertilizer. The biogas system installed in Cameroon connects a septic tank to biodigesters linked to individual households. Human waste placed in the septic tank is converted into biogas by the biodigesters, and this releases energy into people's homes. More than 3,000 households and local schools in two towns have reportedly installed the biogas system. It is estimated that the project may reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the vicinity by up to 60%. The project was initiated by Bioenergy Cameroon, a non-governmental youth organization. The group trains local students, especially female students, on how innovative technology like solar power and biogas work.
Scientists at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory's National Ignition Facility in California have announced a breakthrough in the development of nuclear fusion, promising an inexhaustible supply of energy. The fusion process uses a fuel capsule placed inside a tiny gold case called a Horalm, which is bombarded by 192 laser beams. The temperature inside the Horalm is lowered to more than 400 degrees below zero Fahrenheit to facilitate the fusion reaction. The fuel capsule contained two hydrogen isotopes, deuterium and tritium. After laser beams were released, the gold wall of the Horalm converts them into X-rays. At high temperatures, the nuclei of the deuterium and tritium are fused together and alpha particles are produced, generating energy. The milestone that the scientists achieved is known as ignition, where the energy produced was greater than the amount of energy put in.
UK.
Alrighty then. So let's stop it right there. And so basically, you just heard them say that it produced, that particular deal put it produced more energy, that it put out more energy than it actually took in. So according to the laws of physics, they say that's not even possible. But, you know, hey, let's keep moving right along. Pause that just for a second. So they're telling you, basically, free energy is possible. They're telling you that. And all these different technologies. But nonetheless, you got to get it into place, you got to pay a lot of money, you got to pay extra taxes, extra fuel taxes, and so on in order to get it together. But, you know, what about the average Joe pulling their resources and actually making it happen, you know, on their terms as opposed to the system's terms? That's just throwing it out there. Good question.
So what we are looking at here is a computer from the 1930s. And it's actually a device that is working based on mechanical moving parts. Fast forward 10 years, in the 1940s, you got this kind of machine. That beast is actually an all-electronic computer. It's not too far off in terms of conceptual ways of operation from what we have today. But obviously, it's a lot bigger and less powerful than what we have, which now looks like this. This is our computer today. A lot smaller, a lot more affordable, and a lot more powerful. Now that's the, you might say, the information processing branch of electrical engineering. How about the electricity generation branch of electrical engineering? This is the generator you had 100 years ago powering your house. It was essentially an engine that would spin a generator of electricity. What do we have today? We have this. It's a lot more powerful, but it's also a lot bigger and a lot more complex and a lot more expensive. So how come we haven't made the same type of progress that we have with information processing in electricity generation? Why is it that we haven't made all these simple, small, compact devices that don't involve mechanical moving parts and can harvest all sorts of waste energy and create electricity for us?
I can answer that question. Because the system, the energy industry, and the governments of the world, they don't want that technology available, because that means they can't tax you for it. They can't put a meter on it, Mr. J.P. Morgan. And so, with that said, they got to keep you on what they like to call fossil fuel. Fossil fuel to make it sound, you know, like it's rare. Oh, it's like a diamond, you know. We got to dig this out of the ground. We got to crack up the ground. We got to use fracking to pull gas and stuff out of the ground in order to be able to do that. And it's an expensive process, so we got to move that expense over to you, the average Joe, you know, the consumer. Yeah, that's the whole dirty little secret of the whole deal. The fact of the matter is, you can make your own biofuels at home. You can turn your septic tank, if you have one of those, into a doggone biofuel system. You can take any waterway that you got around that might have duckweed and watermill, or you can take grass clippings, wood chips. You know, you don't even have to cut down trees. Just wait for parts of the tree to fall off or die, and then grind that up into pellets, and you can turn that into energy. You could either turn it into heat energy, or you could actually turn it into energy used to use that heat energy to turn it into electricity, the same way we've been doing it all this time. Why is it, like you said, why is it we haven't moved forward in electrical generation? We're still using old ancient technology. Essentially, we are we're burning stuff in order to make boil water to heat steam and use that steam pressure to do work. So, there you go. Oh, that's the answer.
And what I'd like to point out is that I think, and you know, obviously there's a lot of technical difficulties, but I'd like to suggest that the core of the problem, the main reason why this has happened, is one fundamental property of materials. And that's the fact that conductors of electricity also conduct heat. Let's see how that plays out. What we are looking at here is a schematic of a piece of metal. In this, we have all these little tiny particles called electrons. Electrons are charged particles that are responsible for the flow of electricity. Electric current means the movement of these electrons. Now, imagine I wanted to get electrons to move from one part of this material to another so that I have electric current. How would I do that? So, one way to do that would be, for instance, to give electrons thermal energy, heat up a part of this material. And I could think of multiple ways of doing that, but here's one example. If I take a beam of laser and point it at the middle of that piece, well, I would heat that portion. And that heat would basically set the electrons in that portion of the material to movement. But you might say I'm being a little too clever here, because there is a problem. As soon as I try to heat that part of the metal, what happens? That heat spreads to everywhere in that metal. It's not just that portion that gets heated up. Now, what's the consequence? Well, the consequence is that electrons everywhere in that piece of metal gain a lot of energy. So all of them start moving in all sorts of random directions. And as a result, there is no net flow of current. I have electrons moving in all directions. So,
pause this for a second. He's talking about the heat that is spread out. When you start heating an object, that heat can transfer throughout the entire deal. That's when the Seebeck effect would actually stop, because once the temperature difference are basically all sides of that particular device or material reach the same exact temperature, that you no longer have the electron flow, so you that Seebeck effect, it stops. Once nature balances that temperature out, then the free electricity is over. But if it can never reach that balance, then it'll continue on forever. So just by focusing, like this is what he's trying to explain here, by focusing that energy in and using a material that won't allow it to disperse that energy equally as far as the heat energy, you can pull electricity off of the doggone thing. That's why the thermal couple and the thermal pile work so well, because of the way they're actually designed. And the actual Peltier element as well. You can get energy out of the Peltier element if you understand you have to have a temperature difference on both sides of it. So let's keep going.
Outcome. Everything cancels out. So if I wanted to have net current generated in this manner, I would have to be able to localize
the heat that I generate with that beam of light. And what I want to discuss today is an effect that allows us to do that. This is how it works, or this is how I think it works. In fact, we don't really know the physics of it properly yet, but this is how we think it works. Imagine that same piece of metal, but now I carve out a very thin wire out of it. A wire that's so thin such that its diameter is on the order of a nanometer. A nanometer is roughly a billion times smaller than my height. Now what happens is the same piece of metal, if you make it so narrow, will start exhibiting different properties. The flow of electrons as well as the flow of heat will change. And this is not only because of this quasi one-dimensional nature of heat transfer, but also because of some additional potential quantum mechanical effects. But we don't want to get into the detail of that. The end result, we think, is this. What you're looking at here is that same laser beam illuminating a portion of that metallic wire. And the hot region, in this case, is confined to where the laser beam is. The heat is not traveling across. If this actually works, it means that I can get electrons from that region to other places in the metal. And that would give me a net flow of electricity. Now, you might say this is something too small. It's not really of a practical use. But what you can do is stack many of these next to each other, such that you create effectively a macroscopic bulk structure. But its internal nanostructure will allow it to have these additional properties like what we are talking about here. Now, the way we came about this effect and the way we thought about making this kind of structure wasn't by this logic that I described. It started out of an accidental discovery. And that was this observation. Take this structure. This is what we call a carbon nanotube forest. And what it is essentially a forest of tiny cylindrical structures that are hollow, so we call them nanotubes. Their diameter is on the order of a nanometer or so. And they're made out of carbon atoms. And you can indeed make arrays of these that form bulk structures, but they have this internal arrangement of these individual tubular structures. We have a laser beam illuminating a part of this nanotube forest. And as you can see on this schematic, the heat is confined to the region where the laser beam is striking the structure. This is a cartoon, but what about reality? Well, here is a photo of a carbon nanotube forest. And on the sidewall of this photo, you can see that I'm showing an electron microscope image that actually shows individual carbon nanotubes aligned and forming this macroscopic structure. And this forest of carbon nanotubes is a few millimeters across, so it's actually a microscopic piece that you can hold in your hand. And we are illuminating it with a laser beam. Now, if you take a camera and take a picture of the side of this forest where it's being illuminated, you see this. There you see a glow. And the glow that you're looking at is not the laser beam. It's actually incandescence from that spot. That spot that's being heated by the laser beam. The laser beam itself has been filtered out in this image. So you see the glow. Any hot surface will glow. And this surface is in fact at about 2000 degrees. And that's why it's glowing white hot. So we are seeing something very interesting here that we call heat trap. Carbon nanotubes are conductors. They are conductors of electricity and conductors of heat. Yet, in this particular setup, we see that heat that has been generated by that laser beam is actually confined to where it has been generated, and it's not traveling across the nanotubes. That's why we call it a heat trap. The heat is trapped. Now, again, we don't want to talk about the physics of it here, but let's see if it has any practical consequences for us. Here, we are looking at a little gadget that we've made using carbon nanotube forests. So in that glass tube there, in that glass encasing there, we have a small forest of carbon nanotubes. And they're being illuminated by a laser beam. It's a small handheld laser beam, not very different from what you would use as a laser pointer. And when the laser beam illuminates the sidewall of those nanotubes, you see that they glow very hot. At the same time, if you look at the measurement device that's sitting next to nanotubes and next to this device, you will see that it's demonstrating that there is an electric current flowing in this structure. That electric current is essentially the result of the light that illuminated this structure. and was converted to heat and then to electric current. So in fact, we are seeing that this heat trap effect allows us to create a converter of light to heat to electricity in this case. Now there's also something else that's interesting about this. When we first made this device, we thought, oh, this is, you know, a new concept to heat something with light and then using the mechanism that we call thermionic emission generate electricity. But it turns out interest in this mechanism has been there for about a century now. And in particular, in the 1950s and 1960s, the space industry was very interested in this. So NASA and the Soviet space program tried to make devices that work based on this concept.
Let's pause this for a second. 1950s and 1960s, they were thinking about this particular technology that this man's explaining right here. So here we are 44 years later, according to the math there. And you don't hear about this kind of technology. Well, you do if you're listening to the alternative energy community. You actually listen to things like Robert Murray Smith working with graphene technology and such like that. But all these different he actually painted on the wall a heater system. So if you want to watch that, go check it out. I can't remember what the link to his channel is, but I'll try to find one and post it in the chat room.
The difficulty, or one of the key difficulties, I should say, was the fact that if they wanted to use any source of light that's readily available, and in particular what's of great interest is sunlight, well, if you take a piece of metal and you try to heat it, like we saw before, the heat spreads everywhere. So to actually get the high temperatures that you need, you have to use an enormous amount of sunlight. But it turns out, because we have this confinement of heat to where our light beam is illuminating the material, we don't have any waste. So all the light that goes into our carbon nanotube forest goes into effectively heating the material. And as a result of that, we need very little input power to reach the temperatures that are needed to set the electrons in motion. And to demonstrate that, I'll show you a picture of the same device that you saw on the previous slide, but in this case, it's actually sitting outside the lab on a sunny day in Vancouver. And as you can see, there's just a small lens that you can keep in your hand. And the amount of sunlight that little lens is collecting is sufficient to heat these nanotubes to the temperatures that are needed. Now, contrast that with what you're seeing in the surrounding images. For instance, in the top left, you see a few cars on the side. So that gives you an idea of the size of the mirrors that NASA was using to heat their structures, the amount of light that they had to collect. What I'd like to conclude with is that some of the decades-old challenges of technical problems, such as, for instance, in this case, energy conversion, might find solutions in new materials, in materials that have structures on the order of nanometer or so, where you see interesting new physics, properties that are very counterintuitive compared to what you expect from bulk materials. We are not saying that this heat trap effect might save the world or solve all of our energy problems. But one can't help but wonder, what would the world be like if we had these nanomaterials 50 years ago? Would we still be having all these energy problems? Would we still be using fossil fuels in the same way as we are doing now? Consider the fact that there is so much waste heat and so much waste light around us. More than half of the energy that we extract from primary sources to power our industries and our civilization actually goes to waste heat. And if we could use properties such as this heat trap to harvest a portion of that energy, that could have huge consequences for our access to energy on the one hand, but also implications potentially for the environment. Thank you.
All right, so he said what I've been saying for a long time. It's only a loss if you don't monopolize on it. If you don't use it, that's the only time it becomes a loss of energy. So let's move right along here.
It's a really exciting time to be alive. We have a front row seat to the only known transformation of a world powered by dirty fossil fuels to a planet that gets its energy from renewable, clean sources. It's going to happen just once, right now. These are the top 10 potential energy sources of tomorrow. Number 10, space-based solar power. Every hour, more energy from the sun reaches us than we Earthlings use in an entire year. To try and save a lot more of it, one idea is to build giant solar farms in space that will collect some of the higher intensity, uninterrupted solar radiation. Giant mirrors would reflect huge amounts of solar rays onto smaller solar collectors. This energy would then be wirelessly beamed to Earth as either a microwave or laser beam.
Alright, let's pause this. Once again, this particular technology that he's talking about, I'm saying, nope, that's not a good idea. You don't want to send either a microwave or a laser beam. That's, imagine you got these things floating in space, picking up the doggone sunlight, and then changing that energy into a laser or whatever, a microwave. Let's say something out there in space, for some reason, bumps into that thing and it starts just zapping everybody on the planet. Microwaves or lasers. You know, you're walking down a road and next thing you know, that something bumped into that thing and, you know, redirected that beam instead of where it was supposed to be going. And now it's aimed at your face. And that's probably the worst way to get a sunburn, so to speak. So, you know, with that said, space-based, you know, energy sending down to the world is a ridiculously stupid idea. So, I don't think that's one that they'll ever do anyway. But you know, who knows? You know, the system's been doing stupid stuff forever. But nonetheless, let's go ahead and listen to what they have to say.
One of the main reasons this amazing idea is still just an idea is because it's, big surprise, very expensive. But it could become a reality in the not-so-distant future as our solar technology develops, and the cost of launching cargo into space comes way down, thanks to the work of companies like SpaceX. Number 9. Human power. We already have human-powered devices, but scientists are working on harvesting power generated from normal human movement. We're talking about tiny electronics here, but the potential, when multiplied by billions of people, is big. And with developers making electronics that use less and less power, one day your phone may charge when it rustles around in your pocket, your bag, or moves in your hand, or your fingers move on the screen. At Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, scientists have even demonstrated a device that uses viruses to translate pressure into electricity. Yes, it's amazing as it sounds, and no, there's no way I'm going to try and explain how it works. Of course, it's linked below if you want more info. There are even small body-worn systems that passively produce electricity when you move. Human power isn't going to solve global warming, but every little bit helps. Number 8, tidal power. Harnessing all the energy in the motion of the ocean could power the world several times over, which is why over 100 companies are trying to figure out how. Because of the focus on wind and solar, the tidal energy industry kind of got elbowed out of the early mix, but these systems are quickly becoming more efficient. For one, meet Oyster, a 2.4 megawatt producing hinged flap that attaches to the ocean floor and, as it opens and closes, pumps high pressure water onshore where it drives a conventional hydroelectric turbine. One of those could power a whole housing development or a couple massive residential towers, roughly 2,500 homes. An engineer with the Air Force Academy has created the Terminator winged-shaped turbine that employs lift instead of drag, allowing it to theoretically harness 99% of a wave's energy instead of the 50% that current tidal projects can get. And Perth, Australia, just got the world's first ever wave-powered desalination plant that provides the city with enough drinking water for 500,000 residents. Number 7, hydrogen. The element hydrogen, by far the most abundant in the universe, is very high in energy, but an engine that burns pure hydrogen produces almost no pollution. This is why NASA's powered its space shuttles and parts of the International Space Station with the stuff for years. The only reason we're not powering the entire world with hydrogen is because it only exists on our planet in combination with other elements like oxygen. You know, good old H2O. Russia even converted a passenger jet to run on hydrogen in the late 80s, and Boeing recently tested small planes that fly on hydrogen. Once the hydrogen is separated, it can be pumped into mobile fuel cells in vehicles that are able to directly convert it into electricity. These cars are now being manufactured on a fairly large scale. Honda is planning on demonstrating the versatility of its new hydrogen fuel cell car by plugging it into a model home in Japan to power the house, instead of the car sucking electricity from the building like its electric-powered competitors have to do. Honda says one of these fully fueled cars could power an entire house for a whole week, or drive 300 miles without refueling.
Pause that for a second. They're talking about powering your whole house with using your car, which is something that I've been saying for years. Imagine a day whenever you go get home from work and you back your car into your garage and it plugs into an outlet, and now you're charging up your house's power banks and running your house off of it. So you just leave the car running while you're going to sleep. You don't have to worry about carbon dioxide fumes or carbon monoxide fumes or any of that kind of stuff. But technology's been around. They've been thinking about it for a long time. These are all things that I've said. If you go back and listen to prior shows on Mad Science, you'll hear me talking about it. And so they already know this, folks. They know it's possible. But for obvious reasons, if you want to stay in charge, you got to make sure you're the one with the information and you're the one with the patents and you're the one with the capability of building these technologies and putting them on the market in a manner in which that they will continue to keep you in power and continue to keep you in money and so on down the line.
The main obstacle right now is the relatively high cost of these vehicles and the lack of hydrogen stations to refuel them. Although California now has plans for 70 of these stations across the state, South Korea is expected to have a total of 43 soon, and Germany is aiming for 100 by 2017. Number 6, geothermal heat from underground lava beds. The method of converting the heat rising from the depths of the molten core of the Earth into energy, also known as geothermal, powers millions of homes around the world, including the electricity usage for 27% of the Philippines and 30% in Iceland. But an Icelandic deep drilling project may have recently discovered the Holy Grail when it hit a pocket of magma, which had only happened once before in Hawaii. The team pumped water down into the hole, which the scorching magma instantly vaporized to a record-setting 842 degrees Fahrenheit. This highly pressurized steam increased the power output of the system tenfold, an amazing success that should lead to a giant leap in the energy-generating capabilities of geothermal projects around the world. Number 5, nuclear waste. Nuclear fission power plants are the traditional reactors that have been in use around the world for decades and provide the United States with 20% of our electricity. They use something called light water technology to surround the fuel rods with water, which slows the neutrons and allows for a sustained nuclear reaction. But the system is really inefficient. Only 5% of the uranium atoms in the rod get used up by the time it has to be removed. All that unused, highly radioactive uranium just gets added to our growing stockpile of nuclear waste. But now, finally, there appears to be another, more efficient way, called a fast reactor, where the rods are submerged in liquid sodium instead of water. This allows 95% of the uranium to be used, instead of the unacceptably inefficient 5%. Adopting this method would solve the huge problem of getting rid of our 77,000 tons of radioactive waste, because these new reactors can reuse it. GE Hitachi has already designed a fast reactor called PRISM, and is shopping it to power companies. But the biggest obstacle is the high cost of building new nuclear power plants. Plus, you have to overcome the political stigma that nuclear is a dangerous energy source. Still, the benefits are huge. It's a proven technology that emits pretty much no greenhouse gases. The big success story is France, who has 75% of its electricity needs met by its 59 nuclear power reactors. Number 4, solar windows. With production and installation costs getting cheaper by the day, solar power is taking off around the world. Europe is the best in photovoltaics and is driven by its leader, Germany. On an average sunny day in 2012, Deutschland got as much energy from the sun as 20 nuclear power stations, enough to power 50% of the country. Spain is now generating more than 50% of its power from renewable resources like solar. A California desert is home to the largest solar power station in the entire world, and the United States increased its solar capacity by nearly 500% from 2010 to 2014. And if you think that that's as fast as solar can possibly grow, listen to this. Researchers at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico just made a significant breakthrough in quantum dot solar cell technology that will allow highly efficient solar panels to double as transparent windows. When this technology becomes cheap enough to hit the mass market in the next couple of years, every sun-exposed window in the world will have the potential to be converted into a mini power station. Number 3. Biofuels. From 2002 to 2013, biofuels grew more than 500% in the U.S. as production of crop-derived ethanol and biodiesel became a mainstream substitute or supplement to gasoline in our cars. In fact, back in the day when Henry Ford first developed his Model T, he thought it would run on ethanol. The discovery of vast amounts of cheap oil all over the world unfortunately made it the go-to energy source, but renewable biofuels are making a strong comeback now. The only problem is that the currently dominant first generation of biofuels use the same land and resources that have traditionally been used to grow food, which is driving up the cost of food and causing big problems in a lot of the developing world. So something has to change if biofuels are going to give us a chance at replacing oil with something clean burning. That's where a plant like switchgrass comes in. It's hardy, it grows like a weed just about anywhere, and it isn't food. But if we wanted to run all of the world's cars on it, we'd need to plant it on an amount of land equivalent to the entire countries of Russia and the United States combined.
Pause there, which is a ridiculous suggestion that you have to take away farmland because you don't. And going back to Henry Ford wanting to run his basic on biofuel way back in the day, and then crude oil came into the picture, which was a cheaper, more, available, easier to get a hold of, according to them. And either way, you don't have to take up a bunch of farmland, and you don't have to jack the prices up to generate biofuel, because everything that you do right now, including mowing your lawn, grass clippings, instead of having to be put into a special bag and go to a special type of landfill or whatever, can be turned into biofuels. So they don't talk about that kind of stuff. Instead, they're talking about how if you use corn to make ethanol, or even moonshine for that matter, that you're going to cause the food prices to go up higher, and plus, you have to use up more land, which is a lie. It's a bold-faced freaking lie in the alternative energy community, as well as in the mainstream system. Anything, any dead bugs for that matter, anything biological can be turned into a fuel source. And they know this. I'm telling you, folks, they know it's possible. But they're not going to tell you that. But now that you've got that bit of information, that opens a wide door for you to be able to turn your trash into fuel, to whatever that you think nature, has wasted or whatever. Tree limbs falling off after ice storms, they got to be cleaned up, they got to be mulched up, they got to be used. So why not use that to make gasification systems or biofuels or whatever? And, there you go. If you can't find free energy at this point in the game, you're simply not paying attention and you're not listening to mad science. The thing is, we got to get all the average Joes together to understand that all this technology has been around forever and a day, and it's just not being implemented by the system for obvious reasons. They want you to pay them. They want you to pay them for drinking water. They want you to pay them for medicines. They want you to pay them for electricity and everything. That's a whole deal. It's just all money game. It's a, man, think about it. They want to charge you a carbon tax. Cost you money just to exhale. It's ridiculous. Let's keep going.
So that's not going to work. This brings us to the third generation of biofuels, algae, which has all the right ingredients to replace oil once and for all. Algae's natural oil content is greater than 50%, which means...
Pause. algae's normal oil content is more than 50%. How much algae you think's in this world? How much? This world is a self-contained biosphere of epic proportions. It rejuvenates itself. It regenerates. It mixes and stirs and makes all kinds of stuff constantly. Until this world stops doing what it's doing, you're never going to run out of fossil fuels, what they like to call fossil fuels. Never, ever, ever will you see a day when the oil industry runs out of it. If anything, there's going to come a point in time when they finally do switch over all this that they got to find other alternative uses, which they've already had. Plastics, anything made from petroleum products, whatever. So they're still going to be able to make money. They're just not going to be able to make the money in the same form that they have. Maybe by the time they get around to it, they'll turn around and the plastics will cost you more because they can't sell near as much, supply and demand or whatever. And, they'll still be in business. If they paid attention to mad science, they'll still make money. They just won't be making it in the fuel industry, which is crazy. You know, because even if they had some common sense, they could still make some money in the fuel industry instead of using, you know, what the oil in the natural sense, they would actually turn around and, make the equivalents of biofuels. Whatever. But, you know, hey, who am I? I'm just the guy that paid attention in science class.
It can be easily extracted and processed. We can convert the remaining parts of the plant into electricity, natural gas, and even fertilizer to grow even more algae without chemicals. Algae grows quickly and doesn't need farmland or fresh water. Just last month, Alabama became the world's first algae biofuel system that can also effectively treat human wastewater. This actually resulted in a carbon negative outcome. The 40,000 a day demonstration plant basically...
Pause. Talking about using algae in the same exact process to treat human waste products. So that means that all these different water treatment facilities, instead of having to use chemistry the way they have in order to try to make this water where it's reusable in the system again, it already does the job. So this is what I've been saying for a long time. You know, just take duckweed alone. That duckweed is a fertilizer. You can use it for chicken feed. Worst case scenario, you can cook it properly. People can eat it because it's highly in protein and nutrients that it basically filters out of a pond or whatever. Plus, you can turn it into biodiesels and you can turn it into fertilizer. So you can recycle last year's fertilizer over and over again. And the stuff in the right conditions will double its in size in 24 to 48 hours. You can skim off half of it every day, and then, you know, within a day or so, you've got just as much or more than you had prior. So, it's a no-brainer. Plus, it would solve all the problems of having to use herbicides to put out there in, like, the golf courses that... turn around and you're going to try to kill it off using herbicides in order to be able to keep their ponds and lakes on the golf course looking beautiful. But nonetheless, even the pesticides that they're using, all that kind of stuff, everything that they think they're doing to try to control it and make this thing look beautiful, now fertilizing the heck out of the doggone grass in order to make sure that it stays green and lush for the golfers. Where do you think that nutrients is going? It's going down into the waterway. It's throwing that waterway off of balance, which in turn nature puts in the filtration system, which is the duckweed and the algaes, and tries to break it back down. But because it's happening so rapidly, it takes longer. And if it takes longer, then that means the golf course looks all yucky because the doggone pond is green instead of clear. So it's a no-brainer, once again. And they know this. They know it is possible.
We floated giant bags on a bay, pumped wastewater into them, added a little algae, and then let the sunlight do its thing. Before long, algae had grown everywhere and cleaned the wastewater so well it could either be released back into the bay or reused by people as drinking water. Number 2, flying wind farms. We're already getting a lot of energy from the wind. but with the buoyant air turbine, or BAT, that floats 1 to 2,000 feet above the ground where winds are stronger and more consistent, we could soon be getting that energy much more efficiently. The system is simple. A ringed blimp with a wind turbine in the middle is tethered securely to the ground. It will produce twice as much power as similarly sized tower-mounted turbines. It can even handle winds of more than 100 miles per hour. It can be fitted with additional devices like a Wi-Fi unit, which would help bring the internet to parts of the world that don't have it yet.
Okay, let's pause this for a second. This particular technology is like a balloon that's turned into a turbine that can go way up there, and it can get a lot of electricity, you know, because the environmentalists are worrying about the blades from the standard wind mills, wind turbines that you're seeing, karate chopping birds out of the sky and such. And so, you know, the environmentalists are hollering about all these different types of technology, while at the same time hollering about we got to get to clean, renewable, alternative, sustainable energies. And he's actually talking about using this particular one as not just a platform to generate electricity, but as a Wi-Fi tower to send internet to places where they can't get a doggone internet. When it comes to Wi-Fi, the best advantage is to have a good line of sight with the signal coming out so you can keep your internet going if you're doing it wirelessly. So, you know, hey. Like I said, who am I? I'm just the guy that paid attention in science class. So, you know, hey, if the world don't want to listen, then I don't know what else to do but what I've been doing. So let's keep rolling.
The buoyant air turbine was designed for bringing renewable wind energy to rural parts of the world, where building a traditional wind turbine was impossible, and will first be deployed in Alaska. It can even automatically detect and adjust its floating height to where the best wind speed is. When the wind speed is dangerously high, the thing will dock itself, eliminating the need for manual labor. Flying wind turbines like this should soon replace all the less efficient tower-based systems and could allow for the construction of offshore wind farms that have, until now, been really expensive to build. Number 1. Fusion. Unlike fission, nuclear fusion doesn't create any deadly nuclear waste because it fuses atoms together instead of splitting them apart. So there's no threat of a runaway reaction that could lead to a meltdown event. But this is easier said than done. One Nuclear Prize-winning physicist described fusion as trying to put the sun into a box. The idea is pretty, the problem is we don't know how to make the box. The technical issue is that fusion reactions will produce material that's so volatile and hot it will damage the reactor that created it. This isn't stopping private companies and governments from spending billions to research the technology and solve these problems. And if the immense challenges can be overcome, fusion will provide virtually limitless energy and power the world. That's why the world's wealthiest governments are collaborating on the controversial International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor in France, known as ITER. When was the last time Russia, China, Europe, and the United States collaborated on anything? That's how important for humanity this project is, and because of its revolutionary potential, several powerful companies like Lockheed Martin are quietly working on their own fusion reactors. Lockheed has a very optimistic timeline for their system, projecting that they will meet global energy demand by 2050. Their optimism may be fairly justified. In October 2013, in separate research, scientists at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in the United States achieved a huge milestone in fusion when, for the first time, a fuel capsule gave off more energy than was applied to it.
All right, gave off more energy than it was applied to. Hey, I thought they said the laws of thermodynamics wouldn't allow for that. Seriously. And my question is, once these governments and all get these things resolved, do you think that they're going to stop going to war with each other? Seriously, do you think they're going to stop going to war because they no longer need what they like to call fossil fuel? I want you to ponder on that for a bit. The reason why we go to war anymore these days, unconstitutional wars as far as I'm concerned, basically, you know, dumb stuff, is for resources. And if you got this energy thing solved, you ain't got no resources to fight over. And besides that, you don't even need a full fusion in order to generate the amount of energy that one just talked about. I've been talking about plasma technology forever and a day. My channel is based a lot off of Tesla and plasma technology. So, you know, I've been saying forever and a day, plasma technology is the way to go. You can get a lot of heat for a little bit amount of input, which would have otherwise been considered to be wasted heat energy, now becomes a plus. You can make thermoelectric generators using a little high voltage power supply that barely takes any power. So, you know, hey, who am I to say? I'm just a guy that paid attention in science class. They know it's possible, but do you know it's possible? And does the average Joe out there know it's possible? You know, everybody out there says that they want to not have to pay electric bill. I'm telling you, we can get there anytime we choose to step over that fence, but it's going to take a combined effort of all the average Joes as opposed to waiting around for the system to do it. The system already knows it's possible, and they're gearing up to make sure that the infrastructure is in play, that when they do it, that it's going to still give them money. That's the whole deal, folks. It's all about, they got to make sure that before they put new technologies on the table, that they can sell the old technology, and it's going to make them money. Think about it. If what I'm saying is wrong, why do they keep investing in it? Why does all these governments keep doing it? Why does NASA keep making all these amazing claims? They got a hydrogen rocket, for Pete's sake, that they're supposedly using to go to Mars. You know? And this hydrogen rocket engine actually produces its own rain cloud. And that's only running for 60 seconds. Imagine if it was running for a month solid. We'd have catastrophic weather everywhere. It'd be flooding galore. You could take one of these engines into drought-stricken areas and run that doggone thing and put water back on the table again. But who am I? Just a guy that paid attention in science class. Let's move along.
Hey, 42 here. Inside the burning heart of the sun is the most powerful power plant in our solar system. An awesome mass of plasma at 15 million degrees Celsius. It is so hot and under such immense pressures that the sun's core is the most perfect environment in our solar system for a remarkable reaction to happen. Nuclear fusion. At the center of all atoms is a nucleus that has a positive charge. Usually, when two nuclei collide, they repel and bounce off each other, like two positive ends of a magnet. Inside the sun, however, the nuclei are being compressed together under such immense pressures and high temperatures that they have nowhere else to go. The power of their repulsion is too weak to overcome the overbearing force. So usually they do the only thing they can do, combine. And so the two nuclei fuse, hence nuclear fusion, creating a larger atom. In the sun, this is usually hydrogen atoms fusing to become helium atoms. Nuclear fusion causes the sun to burn away 4.3 million tons of mass per second, the equivalent of exploding 4 trillion Hiroshima bombs every second. A byproduct of this is energy, and lots of it. It radiates from the sun and bathes our solar system in light and life. Without this reaction occurring ceaselessly, as it has done for 4.6 billion years, the sun would die, and so would all life we know. Now, what if we could create our own miniature sun here on Earth? Well, that's exactly what scientists all over the world are currently trying to do, simulating nuclear fusion in a controlled environment by creating a fusion reactor could supply planet Earth with unlimited clean energy for the rest of humanity's existence. And it gets better. The only fuel needed is plain old seawater. Seawater happens to be rich in deuterium, one of the most ideal hydrogen isotopes needed for nuclear fusion. And there is enough seawater to power our planet for 2 billion years. Fusion has huge benefits over nuclear fission. Fission is the process of splitting atoms used by our current nuclear reactors. Fusion is significantly cleaner than fission. There is almost no nuclear waste to speak of. The amount of energy produced is also incomparable. Using equal quantities of fuel, fusion releases at least 4 million times the energy of burning coal and at least 4 times the energy of fission. Just a tiny half a gram of hydrogen fuel produces 500 megawatts of electricity. Fusion produces no greenhouse gases, only helium, which is inert. But what if it all goes up in flames? Surely Chernobyl would look like a tea party compared to a meltdown at a fusion reactor. After all, it is simulating the sun, and the sun is a big and scary fireball. Well, actually, no. Fission is a chain reaction. Nuclear power plants are essentially harboring a controlled nuclear bomb. If we lose control, then the chain reaction takes over, and boom! Fusion is the complete opposite. In the event of a meltdown or other accident, there would be no chain reaction. It's hard enough to create the perfect conditions for fusion to happen in the first place. So if anything did go awry, then the conditions would no longer be right for fusion to occur, and the reaction would almost immediately stop. Fusion, then, it seems, is one of those rare things in life that is all pros without a single con. It truly is the holy grail of energy production. So, why aren't we building them everywhere? Well, there is currently one rather large con. We can't bloody do it. Fusion requires the most perfect conditions to take place. I mean, it is like trying to create the sun in miniature on planet Earth inside a box.
Pause. Fusion is ridiculously simple, and it doesn't take all the high-tech knowledge out there that these people try to make it sound like. It happens on a small scale wherever there's plasma. So, you know, ridiculous, things like we can't do it is just mind-blowing. I did a video about high-voltage water heater or plasma water heater or something like that. I can't remember which one it actually was, but nonetheless, if you make basically a vacuum spark gap with a tube that goes through it, and then you shoot a high voltage across there with argon gas surrounding it, you actually generate plasma like you do in a plasma ball. And if you take your finger and you put it on that plasma ball, you can make those little lightning bolts move around. And if you put a piece of metal or a penny or something like that on there, you can actually find out that when that electricity hits that, it'll actually burn, put little burn marks on you. You can actually burn, paper by bringing that energy up out of that doggone plasma ball. But down there at the heart of that thing, imagine the temperature that's going on right at the heart of that plasma where the doggone tubing and everything would be surrounded by this argon gas that's been energized into the fourth state of matter. Well, you can turn around and transfer that heat energy. You can also pick up the radiant energy off of it as well, plus get invisible light depending on which of the noble gases that you use. You know, if you use halogen, everybody who's ever seen a halogen bulb knows that those things get really ridiculously hot. And you're supposed to be really careful when you change the light bulb in your 12-volt system in your car, if it's a halogen bulb, not to get none of the oil on your fingers onto that glass, because it'll give a spot for that heat energy to basically transfer to and then get that glass so hot that it'll actually crack the bulb, destroying it. So you got to be real careful when you replace those bulbs because of how much heat energy is actually generated. But if you look at the voltage input as opposed to the amount of lumens that these light bulbs put out, there's a reason why they use halogen. So we could actually make a halogen-based plasma reactor and turn around and use that to generate a lot of heat and a lot of light and even radiant energy at the same exact time. And it's not rocket science. Somebody already has the technology to make those plasma bulbs. Now, if they got the technology to do that, then they also have the technology to make a plasma reactor that will actually take that heat from the plasma itself and transfer it into another medium such as water or whatever it is that you want to heat up. You could even use molten salt, and that way that molten salt will hold heat energy a lot longer. It's all about the materials that you want to use and you know, taking the best physics and putting them in order with each other to make the most incredibly efficient machines possible. But don't even think for a second that fusion isn't already here, that the technology isn't already available, because it flat out is. And, you know, if you listen to the mainstream, it's too expensive, we can't do this, we can't do that. But yet they're sitting there telling you out the other side of your neck, yeah, energy's free, but we're going to charge you for it, flat out. That's what they're saying. That's flat out what they're saying. Not those exact terminology, but roundabout way, that's what they're telling you. When they say they have all these technologies, but we can't do it, it's too expensive. You know, and we got to get all this infrastructure in place. There's a reason why they got to get fuel stations all over the place before they put hydrogen technology out there. And it's not for your convenience, folks. It's so they can sell you hydrogen. Think about it.
That's not going to be easy. The frustrating thing about fusion is that we know for sure it is possible. Einstein's theory of relativity saw to that realization 100 years ago. Attempts to create a fusion reactor began in the 40s. You've probably heard all about them and how fusion energy is only 30 years away. Well, they told us that in the 40s. And then again, 30 years later, they proclaim the same thing yet again. In fact, there is a pervasive joke amongst the scientific community that fusion energy will always be just 30 years away. Is this really true? Is unlimited clean energy only a pipe dream that we can never realise? Well, maybe not. Amazingly, scientists have already done it. There are two primary types of fusion reactor design. One invented by Russian scientists is called the tokamak. This is a large torus surrounded by powerful electromagnets. The torus is filled with fuel, which is heated up by the electromagnets and thus becomes a super hot plasma. And when I say hot...
Alright, let me pause this for a second. If you look at induction heating technology, then you can understand that the doggone magnetic field, the strongest, most pressurized portion of any magnetic field, is right there at the heart of it. So if you're actually looking at a magnetic field, you're looking at basically the equivalence of a toroid. You know, it's like a big old, almost like a hurricane on both sides, compacted in. The energy is really intense at the center. So if you take a coil and you wrap it around a piece of metal and you push a current to that, the strongest portion of that magnetic field fluctuating inside that metal that's in the center of it is going to cause that metal to get extremely hot. And so with that said, it's already there, and it's been there forever and a day. Induction technology could do a whole lot. That's... Go out and look at, tankless water heaters and really research how those tankless water heaters actually function. You might be surprised. You cram anything through the center of that magnetic field, it's instantaneously, from the pressure and the fluctuation of that field, going to get hot. I mean, it only takes a few seconds, if that long, in order to take a rod of stainless steel and get it to red hot. You know, and even past that. And at some point when that stainless steel rod, it can't take anymore, it reaches its thermal breakdown, it's going to melt right in between there. But in that time, we'll transfer some of that heat energy back to the induction coils, therefore destroying it as well. So you're getting way more power than you're pushing to this thing. And with that technology available, there's ways that we could literally make instantaneous steam, instantaneously separate the hydrogen and oxygen molecules, and increase in amazing amounts of pressure that could run turbines and stuff. And so, you know, with that said again, they know it is possible. Yolande said that Toro's rings, interesting... hold on, I can't read. It's too doggone small. Apologize for that. That's what happens when you get old. Taurus rings, interesting info here. She says, oh, you're welcome, Yolande. Sorry about that. My doggone glasses ain't allowing me to see this tiny. I've got to figure out a way to make that text a little larger. That's what happens when you get old. But nonetheless, you cram any material in the middle of that magnetic field, and that's going to get really super hot. And how did they say fusion occurs? Is when you cram these two nucleus of these two atoms together, the protons in there, and they got no choice but to combine and become one. When they do that, they release a massive amount of heat energy. And so, with that said, electromagnets or even really super strong neodymium permanent magnets doing the same exact job, focusing, until it actually hits into the plasma state and you got a massive amount of energy. They know this, folks. They know it. They know it's possible.
I mean, feckin' hot. The plasma must reach 150 million degrees Celsius before fusion can be achieved. Tokamaks show immense promise for achieving successful fusion on Earth, but it is far from easy. For example, the plasma mustn't touch the walls of the container. If it does, then it cools down too fast and fusion can't.
And it's not even just that right there. The walls of the container, if not produced inside of a vacuum, would have the actual capability of transferring that massive amount of heat energy to the container, causing that container to melt. But for the same exact reason why a tungsten element light bulb is able to function, because all that air is evacuated out of the light bulb, so you get basically a vacuum, and you got a tungsten element running through there. If there's no oxygen and no medium for that heat to transfer through to it efficiently enough, then that light bulb will actually stay on for a long period of time. But even if you've ever looked or touched a doggone regular incandescent light bulb, you'll notice that while that wire is actually red hot inside there, that tungsten element or even nichrome, depending on which one they're using, don't matter, it's all for resistance anyway, that doggone heat will actually transfer to the glass, and those light bulbs will get so incredibly hot you can't touch them with your bare fingers. That's a lot of energy going on. And when you're talking about halogen bulbs, you're talking about literally generating a massive amount of heat energy, and even to the extent where you're into the plasma state now. So there's a whole lot more to the halogen bulbs than meet the eye, but you can take all that technology, and if you understand why that light bulb don't just pop. Now, if you want to see what I'm talking about, simply go get any light bulb really hot, especially a halogen bulb, and just flick a drop of water on there, and you'll see that sucker will explode. It's transferred so much heat energy to that glass, any sudden change, heat expands and cold air contracts, and so that material will take a sudden rapid change that it will literally destroy that light bulb just by getting hot and then throwing some water on there. That's why most of the time when your light bulbs in your car go bad, it's because when you're driving down the road, normally the lenses that cover that light bulb keep the water and the moisture and the cool air from the outside away from that glass on that bulb, so it's kind of warm to the touch when you put your hand on the headlamp, but it's not blazingly hot. But if the seals of those doggone light bulbs are cracked and allows moisture in there, the moment any of that moisture touches that hot bulb instantaneously, it will destroy itself. That's how much power is available.
Happen. The second design, called inertial confinement fusion, consists of a very large football, with the walls lined with the world's most powerful lasers. No, unfortunately, we aren't trying to build a Death Star. A tiny pellet of the fuel, the size of a peppercorn, is placed in the center of the container, and at precisely the same time, the lasers all fire, striking the pellet from every angle, simultaneously. If successful, the pellet has no choice but to implode, creating huge temperatures and immense pressures. Perfect conditions for the atoms within the fuel pellet to fuse together. The first design has been successful. In 1997, the JET tokamak reactor in Oxford successfully produced 16 megawatts of power output. Great! So what's the holdup? Well, they had to use 24 megawatts of heating to run the experiment, a net loss of energy, which rather contradicts the point of power production. Scientists have a neat symbol for the ratio of power used in an experiment compared to the amount of power it produces. Q. If an experiment achieves a Q of 1, it has broke even on power consumption and output. When a Q of more than 1 is achieved, nuclear fusion will be a viable means of power production. The JET reactor produced a Q of 0.67. But a new joint project in
Pause that for a second, and they're talking about how much energy they actually had to use in order to generate that amount of power. But what I've been trying to tell everybody is it doesn't take nowhere near that amount of power. If you're trying to generate high voltages or high current in the standard deal, yeah, you can't get out more than you put in. You can't even break even because there's too many losses in the system. However, if you listen to physics and you paid attention in science class, you can do the same thing using other deals to generate the power, and the way that you deliver the power, we could fix the doggone internal combustion engine just by the way that we actually inject the fuel into the system and by the amount of fuel actually injected into the system. So it's not about we don't have the technology, it's about whether or not you can get engineers to pay attention to somebody like myself and get the job done, for Pete's sake. It's pure ridiculousness. But let's keep going anyway.
And France, backed by the EU, India, Japan, Korea, Russia, China, and the US, called ITER, thinks it has the final solution. ITER claims it will create the first true star on our planet.
Okay, and let's pause this for a second, and you need to pay really close attention to how many people and countries are involved in this project right here. Pay real close attention.
Absolutely huge reactor they are creating, several times the size of JET, is predicted to achieve a Q of 10. So for every megawatt they put into it, 10 megawatts of clean energy will be produced. So they say. It sounds fantastic, until you learn that ITER won't even be turned on until 2025, and it's only a proof of concept. It will never produce energy for civilians. If it works, it's estimated that it will be a further 10 years after ITER before fusion energy power plants are available for real-world usage. So that could be 2035 or even 2050, since bureaucracy often delays such projects immensely. Perhaps fusion is yet another 30 years away after all. Don't get me wrong, ITER is an essential and amazing project, and quite a feat of political collaboration too. But in 30 years, a lot can happen. The population is going to balloon even more. Energy needs will skyrocket, with China and emerging powers like India on the rise, and an awful lot more fossil fuel is going to be consumed. But, you see, I think fusion energy is a lot closer than that, for one major reason. Private industry. Just look at how ridiculously wealthy the current oil and gas companies are.
Sorry, I thought it was at that point right there when they talked about all the different countries that were involved in the specific project that actually is what we're talking about. Now, these folks are actually putting money into this project. Why would they be concerned? You know, why would they want to have their hands in it? Because if somebody ever stumbles across it, if you've got your foot in the door, so to speak, you're part of the game, you own it too. So if any one nation gets it, they all get it, and so one nation can't use it as power over any other nation. So that's why, because they want to build this thing, they want to ensure that they keep, to where, it can't become a power source that would basically cripple another nation by putting energy out there so ridiculously cheap that, it's going to cause them financial distress or whatever. Complete, collapse. Let's keep going. I'll see if I can find that spot again.
The company that is the first to crack commercially viable nuclear fusion is going to generate immense investment and wealth, not to mention political and military power. That's exactly why the world's largest defense contractor, Lockheed Martin, is currently developing a compact fusion reactor that could be carried inside a van and power an entire city. But it's not just the big boys. There are literally hundreds of startups worldwide that are racing to be the first to bring nuclear fusion to the masses. Some claim within the next 10 years. Three of the most ambitious private enterprises are Canada-based General Fusion, who have designed a unique steam-powered piston reactor that works along a similar principle to a car's combustion engine. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos is a big fusion proponent. He has invested millions into General Fusion. Tokamak Energy in the UK, that aims to produce more compact tokamaks. And Commonwealth Fusion Systems in the US, which has the same goal, to create a compact reactor. With competition comes progress, especially competition amongst well-funded private entities. The entry of private companies into the realm of space travel has proven that. But what makes all these attempts so different to the many that have come over the past century, that promised nuclear fusion within the next 30 years? Well, this time, it really is different. All those previous attempts may not have proved fruitful, but they were by no means wasted. They provided the world with invaluable research. Most world-altering discoveries and inventions over history did not originate from light bulb moments in which a scientist wakes up one day and has a game-changing revelation. Some, perhaps. But most of them were the result of cumulative research over many decades or centuries by hundreds of different scientists all over the world, building upon the scientific papers and research from their peers and predecessors. The best example of this cumulative research is in your pocket. No, not that. Why do you have that in your pocket? I'm talking about your smartphone. This device, less than a centimeter thick, has more computing power than all of NASA's computers put together when they put man on the moon. And it only exists because of decades of small but meaningful incremental improvements, many thousands of them. In fusion, the rate of these small discoveries is increasing rapidly, helped in part by improved AI. Just take a look at this chart of the number of fusion-related discoveries over the past 50 years. We know fusion works. The sun has proven that. And there will come a point, perhaps very soon, when all these small incremental improvements reach a critical mass and positive G-fusion will finally be achieved. When that happens, the world will quickly become a very different place. But how? Well, there are obvious environmental benefits to finally having a reliable, abundant, clean energy source. Some scientists think that fusion energy could be humanity's sole savior from destroying our own planet through global warming. According to some of the more pessimistic predictions out there, if we don't crack nuclear fusion within the next 30 years, humanity could be doomed. But something that is far more tangible and certain is that nuclear waste would stop being produced. Current nuclear fission power keeps our modern world ticking over. It's far more reliable than the alternatives, and today it is actually safer than renewable energy. Seriously, look it up. But it does have a deadly byproduct that we still don't quite know how to store safely in a way that may not harm future generations. But beyond living in a cleaner world, the unlimited energy that fusion would bring into the world would change Earth forever. Electricity costs would plummet, meaning that developing countries would be able to steam ahead and, well, develop like never before. Such nations would finally have access to energy-hungry applications such as advanced water treatment. Some think that after the initial costs have been covered, energy would become so cheap it would be just handed out to all citizens by some nations, almost like a human right. With unlimited energy, space exploration could accelerate astronomically. Imagine being able to send a large manned spacecraft into the depths of space that had an onboard fusion reactor. multiple generations could live and die aboard this craft without it needing to ever return to Earth. Back on Earth, the scale of projects would reach previously unforeseen horizons. With unlimited power, sci-fi dreams like floating cities, underwater cities, huge theme parks and resorts in the desert, underwater, and in the frozen wastes of Antarctica would all become financially feasible once we have developed all the ancillary technology. Now, you may not necessarily want a huge theme park in the desert, and these are obviously no more than senseless ramblings from my brain. It may not happen like this, but change would happen on a tremendous scale. The important lesson here is not to give up on impossible dreams. The very fact that humanity is still striving to better itself, whether it be fusion energy or medical advances, is a remarkable thing indeed. When we are being bombarded 24/7 by news of climate change and impending doom, one should never fail to underestimate the resolve and ingenuity of the human spirit. Thanks for watching. I've recently launched my first book.
Alrighty then. So, moving right along, but basically, to recap all that deal, fusion technology would have the capability of changing the world for the better if it was in the proper hands and if it didn't basically replace the system that we're in right now. To the extent where, like J.P. Morgan, you can't put a meter on it, so you're not going to want to use it. You can't make no money off of it. And all the justification is, oh, yeah, well, we got to pay for all the work we did. We got to pay our workers to maintain and all this kind of stuff. But if you understand all of what you've been hearing right here, the energy's been free the whole entire time. The apparatus is what everybody keeps complaining why energy ain't free, because you got to build it or whatever. But you got the manpower, the woman power, the technology, you got all the information. All you need to do is come together and put the stuff to in order and make it so, you know. And you could go in so many different directions and solve so many different problems, energy related and health related and, you know, multiple others, which, if everyone was self-sufficient, there wouldn't be no reason for people to go out there and be fighting over resources. And there's so many ways to look at all this kind of stuff that, you know, you're unlimited. Not only in the opportunities or the directions that you could go, but the actual, you know, resources available as well. And, you know, in the knowledge available in order to make it happen. It's already, free energy's already been here forever and a day. We're just sitting here mincing words and basically trying to figure out why the system hasn't already done it. If they know it's possible, then why haven't they done it? Well, obvious. They want to stay in charge. That simple.
So now we're searching for the magic frequency. And we start with 100 hertz, and we look through the microscope to see if anything's happening. We watch for 5 minutes. Nothing happens. We try hundreds and hundreds of frequencies, if not thousands, until we find the magic combination. Because we believed there just had to be a better way. There had to be a better way. And we think we may have found it. I have here two identical tuning forks, both tuned to the note A, the note an orchestra tunes to. These forks are both made to vibrate 440 times per second. We say their frequency is 440 hertz. If I tap this fork, putting little pulses of energy into it, the second fork will also vibrate in sympathy. And if I silence this fork, we just may hear the other singing its tone. We say that I'm inducing a sympathetic resonant vibration in the second fork. It only works because both forks are tuned to the exact same frequency. Now, many of us have seen this very charming young man on the internet who shatters crystal glasses with his powerful voice. But if you watch him carefully, you'll see that first he taps the glass with his finger and listens. The glass sings its natural resonant pitch. Then he takes a deep breath and sings a loud, long note. He induces a resonant vibration in the crystal glass. The vibration grows larger and larger and larger until the glass is shattered. On the other end of the scale, we have a giant bridge made out of concrete and steel, a suspension bridge, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. Cars and trucks and buses are going over it every day. And unfortunately, where they built this bridge, there was a steady wind blowing across it. And one day this wind induces a small vibration in the bridge, hardly noticeable. But the frequency of the vibration matches the resonant frequency of some part of the bridge. And the vibration gets larger and larger and larger until the bridge collapses into the river below. A destructive resonant frequency. So on one end of the scale, we have a giant concrete and steel bridge destroyed by resonance. And on the other, we have a small crystal glass shattered. So maybe we could shatter something even smaller. Something really small. Something you would need a microscope to see. Maybe we could shatter a living microorganism. So maybe we could change a biological living liquid crystal with a special electronic signal. But in order to do that, we would need some kind of device. So we searched the U.S. patent database, and we find this invention by a physician, Dr. James Baer of Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's called a resonant frequency therapy device, and its purpose is to induce a resonant vibration in a living organism or cell. If I put in, say, 100 hertz, out will come 100 pulses per second. If I put in 200 hertz, we'll get 200 pulses. So now we're searching for the magic frequency. And we start with 100 hertz, and we look through the microscope to see if anything's happening. We watch for 5 minutes. Nothing happens. So we try 101 hertz. We look through the scope for 5 minutes, and nothing happens. So we try 102, 103, and so on. Over the course of 15 months, we try hundreds and hundreds of frequencies, if not thousands, until we find the magic combination. The answer is you have to have two input frequencies, one low, one high, and the higher frequency must be 11 times the lower. It's what we musicians would call the 11th harmonic. When we add the 11th harmonic, we begin to shatter microorganisms like a crystal glass. These are the first videos taken. We showed these videos to our friends in the biology department. They said they hadn't seen anything quite like it. It seems to be a new phenomenon. These organisms are being shattered by our electronic signals. We now know that cancer is vulnerable between the frequencies of 100,000 hertz and 300,000 hertz. So now we attack leukemia cells. Leukemia cell number one tries to grow a copy of itself, but the new cell is shattered into dozens of fragments and scattered across the slide. Leukemia cell number two then hyperinflates and also dies. Leukemia cell number three then tries to make another cancer cell. The new cell is shattered and the original cell dies.
So, according to the alternative energy and medicine industry, there was a guy named Dr. Royal Raymond Rife who was saying that a long time ago, and yet nobody's ever heard about the Rife machine. So, not only can energy be used to, you know, get work done, but it can also be used for healing effects as well. I mean, a lot of folks think you're crazy when you say stuff like that, but if you actually go out and listen to different sounds and you go out and listen to different music, songs or whatever, you'll notice that you have actually a physical effect that can occur from different tones, different sound arrangements, song arrangements. You know, some can lift you up, some can literally make you nauseated. The technology's not new. And as far as frequency ranges, they're like unlimited. It's speeding up, slowing down, you know, magnetic waves or, you know, energy in any form or whatever, you know. But that's all we're talking about. How fast it's pulsing, how fast it's speeding up, slowing down, all that kind of stuff. So all the energy out there, radio waves, waves from space, vibrations from the earth, all of this is energy that if you have a receptor that can receive it, you know, and transfer it to whatever energy form that you want it, you know, including heat, you know, when you rub two things together at the same frequency, you can try it with your hands, you know. At a lower speed, rubbing your hands together, your hands are real warm. And the more you do that, the friction in between there and the frequency at what you're doing it will determine, you know, how hot they get. You start rubbing your hands together really rapidly, and you'll notice that it starts to get hot. You start getting a whole lot more heat generated going on. It's just how frequent you do it, how fast you do it, determining on the frequency range itself. But all we're doing literally is taking one form of energy, changing it to a different form of energy. It's not rocket science. Never has been rocket science. They'd like to make you think it was rocket science. That way you have to, you know, have them to help you out with it. You know, you need electricity. So where do you go now? You go to the professionals, the people that's been doing it since Tesla designed the generator and alternating current and such. And even Edison's DC hasn't never gone away, because there's purposes for DC, there's purposes for AC, all of which you can engineer your machinery around to use incredibly efficient if you choose to do so. And so you can get, at the very least, incredible efficiency, which would bring the price of your energy needs down. But that's not what they want to do. Why? They know it's possible, folks. They've known it. They've known this for decades, if not longer. They've known that free energy is real. Don't tell you, you know, the wind's blowing outside, then they'll say, hey, yo, you put a wind generator up there and you can make electricity. Well, then when you start doing that and they realize it's starting to cut into their bottom line, now they lobby for places to make it illegal. And they get their friends, the environmentalists out there, to say, yeah, that wind turbine's karate chopping birds in half, so you're going to have to take it down. It's an environmental hazard. Or it's making a low pitch hum, you know, and it's driving people insane. So, you know, we got to take it down. Once they realized that they'd opened Pandora's box with all these different alternative energies, the war began of the information in order to keep you stupid. So ignorant of the fact that, you know, this will save you a lot of money. And by telling you that there's problems with it, even nuclear power, by telling you that it's so dangerous, there's problems, environmental hazards, gets you playing on your heartstrings, and you're worried about protecting the world. And in the same sense, you're harming the world because you're still supporting the same system that's doing the same exact thing to you, which is lying and propagandizing and indoctrinating you. And basically programming you to believe whatever they tell you so that they can still stay in power, still stay making money. That's what it's all about. The whole entire system, that's what it's all about. But all these technologies, for everything that they throw negative at you, I can throw 10 to 1,000 positives at you and show you why it is what they're saying is a big lie. The environmentalists out there make me so angry because they complain and complain and complain and protest. In the midst of the protest, leave messes behind and waste time and energy that could be, you know, them gathering together and finding the brilliant minds out here and having them show them, hey, this is what really happens when you do this. And if you're worried about the doggone wind turbines karate chopping birds in half, then put a screen around it. The bird can't even get to it. For Pete's sake, they put fences around radio towers, so if you're smart, you won't climb the fence and get too close to the tower and fry yourself because of the doggone, not the high voltage itself, which could be lethal, but the doggone radio waves that's being produced, the microwaves, that'll cook you from the inside out. That's the whole deal. And so, who am I to say? Once again, I'm just the guy to pay attention in science class. So, I'm going to go ahead and take a short music break, and then I'll come back and wrap this thing up. Peace and love. Stay tuned. You're listening to Mad Science.
Was that that stood up to me?
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh, one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this? You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life. It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
All right, I can describe the ruckus. I just spent the last 3 hours putting information on the table, basically trying to let everybody know and be able to maybe possibly come to the understanding. They know it's possible for free energy. They know for a fact it's possible for free energy. But are they ever going to give it to you, the people? I highly doubt it. Not in the sense that they're talking about, you know, by letting the information out and opening up Pandora's box with other existing alternative technologies and then realizing that it was going to hit them in the wallet. Well, that kind of got them all nervous. And so now they got to put regulations out there so you can't use freely all these technologies without having some sort of consequence and having to pay somebody for the luxury of having solar or wind technology or hydroelectric, whatever. You know, the moment that hydroelectric dam came online, it basically, you know, was free energy for the people, and all they had to do is let that river keep flowing and do a little bit of maintenance, and they could sell you something that nature provided for free, forever. Excuse me, I had to take a drink of my coffee. But nonetheless, it's still the same doggone old concept, you know? They want to charge you for everything that nature's already provided. Now, understandably, if you go to a farmer works hard for growing his fruits and vegetables and all that kind of stuff, and he basically charges you for providing a service and that kind of stuff, which is understandable. So that's why most people think that, you know, if they're going to produce electricity, provide me a service, well, then, you know, it ain't no different than me buying food from the deal. But in reality, when they keep jacking the prices up or taxing this and taxing that for everything under the sun, including the sun, if you decide you want to not have to pay that bill and you buy the equipment not to have to pay that bill, they want to find a way around it to get you to stay on the grid and still pay them money. That's the whole deal. All in a nutshell. It's all about money and power, and that's what it's always been. That's why mad science is around, because I paid attention in science class, and I'm listening to all the craziness out there. They're trying to tell you it's not possible. They're trying to twist the laws of physics to say that it's not possible. And keep in mind, most of what science is out there is all theoretical any doggone way. So they can't prove anything. But we do know that certain causes and certain effects occur, and with the proper research and watching and learning, we can find the ways that are most beneficial to ourselves and society and nature, and, you know, work in perfect balance with nature. Nature's already provided all the energy we could use in a trillion lifetimes. But yet these folks want to charge you for it. That's where the difference is between that and what the farmer's doing out there. You know, and, you know, if it's just about providing a service and you just wanted to be able to, you know, use that service without having to do anything, that'd be fine. But you're always under the threat, they're going to shut you off. You don't pay your bill, they're going to shut you off. And the bills are getting higher and higher every single year because of this bogus climate change, global warming, climate disruption, or whatever's going to be next week when the math don't add up. They're constantly putting you under the threat of doomsday coming around because of so-called carbon emissions and, you know, the world's climate changing. They're always lying to you, propagandizing you, and they get the average Joe to go out there and protest for money in some cases and never solve nothing. We're going around in circles here. never solving nothing. There's still hunger in the world. There's still sickness. There's still wars and rumors of wars, plagues, famine, pestilence, all that kind of stuff. There's still all that. And all of that makes the system money. And when we get our act together as, you know, basically brothers and sisters around the world or citizens of the world or whatever, it don't matter. However, whatever terminology you want to tack on it, you know, you, we the people. And so, you know, this is what it's going to take. You know? And so, there's so much. There's so much. There's so many different possibilities when it comes to energy generation. We like to live comfortably, and that's fine. I want to live comfortably. You want to live comfortably. Everybody in this world should be able to live comfortably. You know, there's all kinds of things out there. Somebody threw a, let's see, let me check here real quick. It was Yolant sent a deal into the chat room for information about HAARP. Yeah, I looked up on HAARP all the different things that they were using it for, an ionospheric heater and so much more. Even use it for weather modifications, weather manipulations and such. But they try to tell you then there ain't no such thing as free energy. All they're doing is throwing nature off balance, and nature comes back with a vengeance. And so, you know, all this technology is reality. But when are we, the people, going to stand up and take it? When are we going to guide it in the right direction? When are we going to stop all the wars and the homelessness and the sickness? That's what I'm asking. And we have that capability. We have the possibility. We have the manpower. We have the resources. We live in this amazing world, and the only obstacle we got is a small minority of little dots out there that we call the elitists of the world and the governments of the world. And the companies and corporations, we outnumber them way more. And if we ever decided to take our own destiny in our hand, we'd get it solved. Folks, you've been listening to the Mad Science Show. If you like what you've heard, please share this podcast. That's all I ask. Just share this information with people. So I'm going to play us out of here with something that the grasshopper was telling the other grasshoppers. And then stay tuned for the Music with Kara Hour. Hope you enjoy it. Peace and love, everybody. Take care.
What was that? It stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one hand.
Ooh, one hand.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one hand.
Yeah, boys, they're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?